argument in the case of People versus Talbert.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Seidel, bar number 17633, and I'm here representing the people of the state of Colorado in this criminal case. This is one of those unusual, in fact, it's one of the very few cases where I get to stand up and say, well, the other side is at least partially right. And they're partially right because they agree with me. I think both sides are pretty clear. They've expressly agreed that the defendant was subject to discretionary parole, and the appearance of the words plus 2 years parole on the minimus was error, and that the proper remedy would have been to strike that phrase plus 2 years parole from the minimus and perhaps substitute something like parole as provided by law. Unless there are questions on that part of the case, I'd like to move on to the procedural issue, which I think is a matter of some public importance, especially to the criminal defense bar and prosecution and bench as well, and all three of those parts of the criminal law.
Now, I'm a little curious as to why the trial court didn't tumble to the fact that that was an illegal provision.
Your Honor, I'd have to agree with you. In fact, one of the points I wanted to make today was that this case, we are using the exception to the rule I'm proposing to establish both the rule and a little bit delineate the exception. This is a case where, in our view, the second motion, 35A motion here, did clearly state on its face that the sentence that was imposed with the plus 2 years parole on the minimus was illegal. I think by 2005, when the trial court actually looked at this second motion, everybody in the state was well aware of Cooper and Martin and that.
And the issue is that in sex offenders, there's discretionary parole, not mandatory parole.
Correct. And it seems to me that the trial court should have recognized by that time, because Martin and Cooper had been well over 4 years old, that the phrase plus 2 years parole would have been an error. So the question that I wanted to ask this court to consider really is not so much whether that error should be fixed. I think we know it should be, but what are we going to do with the vast majority of second post-conviction motions that are both repetitive and assert the same claims that could have been appealed after the denial the first time around, but instead of appealing, the petitioner or the applicant simply presents the same claim to a trial court at the same level. I think this court has a great interest in clarifying the confusion in the bench and bar about the difference between the two standards, the two bars against that kind of activity.
Mr. Seidel, I just ask you a question. I understand. I think I mostly understand your argument. But
you're ahead of me, Judge.
Well, okay, that may be true too. But in any event, why can't we just say, look, this is an illegal sentence, and therefore the procedural bar that would occur, in other areas and other types of things that are raised, period, and just correct the sentence? I mean, just why don't we just make it pretty simple? If it's an illegal sentence, as this clearly was, we're not going to, what's the downside to that?
The downside to it is that we have a published opinion from the Court of Appeals that essentially urges and advises lower courts that whenever they see a claim that's been raised before, they have to get to the merits of that claim, even though perhaps 1, 2, 4, 5 courts at that same level have already reached the merits. And there's nothing to tell the courts that they can eventually stop looking at the merits of these claims because the people that are filing them are abusing the process of post-conviction relief.
That's pretty hard to be that general about it, isn't it? Because here you had one where it turned out to be meritorious.
We did have, this one was meritorious, but, and I can only speak for what we see in, from the records of the trial courts. I would say half of our practice is post-conviction, and of that, a large majority of filings are second and third filings. And trial courts, if they're not untimely, trial courts are addressing the merits, or at least doing their best to address the merits. Sometimes the claims are not exactly easy to figure out because they're pro se, but the long and short of it is that a huge part of, I think, a district court's practice, at least from what we see, is looking at claims that have already been asserted or could have been asserted and that were not appealed the first time around. And this is both in 35A and 35C practice. And I realize we have a 35A case here, but let's face it, the two rules actually allow for, there's quite a bit of overlap in the two rules. And so it seems to me that it would be good for this court to tell the rest of the world, the bench and the bar, how and what to what degree courts can stop looking at the merits of claims and just see that these are repetitive and you had a chance to appeal the first denial and there are important interests served by doing that, and if you didn't do it, we're not going to take a look at those claims a second time.
Could I interrupt one second and just ask, we're sort of talking around this, because maybe we could just make sure we understand what the scope of the rule you're proposing is. Do I understand it right that it is something along the lines that even for an illegal sentence, the only exception to a bar for fully and finally litigated claims is if it appears on the face of the sentence itself that it is illegal? Is that a fair characterization of what you're saying the rule should be?
I think that is one time at which the trial court would say, I realize this is an abusive claim because it was raised once and not appealed. However, on the face of the motion, it reveals a jurisdictional flaw. This court has often said that an illegal sentence or one that doesn't comply with, you know, the statutes is a jurisdictional problem and should be corrected. Now, there are, I'm not saying that's the only exception, Justice Coates. I would say that...
Before you just move on from that, the last thing you said it's a jurisdictional problem and it must be corrected. What is the it? An illegal sentence?
A sentence that does not comport with state statutes, essentially.
Is that with regard to whether it's apparent on the face of the statute? I mean, are you suggesting that there is simply no bar then for fully and finally litigated claims if the claim is an illegal sentence?
Let me see if I understand your question, because...
I took it your position was we have to have some limitation on even claims claiming an illegal sentence. They should only be allowed to be litigated a certain number of times.
That's right, and I guess what my position is, once it's been litigated to the highest court to which an appeal of right can be taken, then when that court, assuming that court denies the relief requested, then that claim has been fully and finally litigated, and it's subject to the abusive, not the abusive process, but the bar of successiveness, which means you can't start the whole process over again once the highest court of right has rejected your claim. That's slightly different than the case we have here, where I'm saying once you raise it at the lowest trial court level, and then when that's denied, you don't appeal it. That's a different abuse, if you will, and it's we refer to it, and this court referred to it as abusive process, I believe, in Rodriguez.
So by making that distinction, you're saying something is really only finally litigated if one does choose to appeal and he gets an adverse ruling, rather than he fails to appeal within the time he's allowed to appeal. Is that right?
That's what I'm saying, and I take that from this court's discussion in Rodriguez, the Rodriguez case from 1996, 914 P. Second 230. And there, this court adopted both the ADA standards governing successive applications and those that are abuse of process. And the ABA standards, in turn, say fully and finally litigated means something where the highest court of right has ruled. Abusive applications are those in which somebody has made an application at the lowest level and has failed to use due diligence in raising it on appeal and instead just raises it again years, perhaps years later, at the same level. And so that's the distinction I'm drawing, and that comes from Rodriguez. Now, I guess one of the position I'm taking is that there's a difference between someone who raises a claim, it's denied, and goes full forth and appeals it and gets an appellate decision and tries to raise it again. Because at that point, an appellate court has rejected the claim and essentially finalized it for all lower courts in which the person would have to proceed if they want to start over again. Every lower court that would see that same claim would know, I don't have any authority to rule on this. It's already been decided by a higher court. Where in this situation that we're in now, the person raises a second claim in the trial court and no higher court has ruled on that claim. And so the second and third and fourth presentation of that claim allows a trial court to reconsider the merits of the claim and effectively judge the other judges at the same level before this one. And this court expressly said, we're not going to allow that in a case called Weiss versus District Court, which was cited in Tolbert. At that point, the court said the facts were that somebody sought a habeas application just after their Rule 35B motion was denied. This was back when 35B was what is now 35C. And the court said that this was a blatant case of judge shopping, and it was inconceivable, and I'm quoting, that one judge would try to entertain a claim assailing another judge's ruling, and that the court had to intervene to prevent and avert judicial chaos by preventing different judges in the same judicial district from reviewing under the guise of habeas actions of their brother judges. That's what we're looking at here. Admittedly, this claim was meritorious, but the general rule is they're not going to be. And right now, you're essentially asking, allowing prisoners to refile repetitive claims in the same lowest court possible in the hope of finding a sympathetic judicial ear. The problem with that is, well, for one thing, it causes mistrust in the lower courts, and that's something that even Weiss recognized. The other thing is that it potentially will shift the burden to the prosecution. If on the fifth try somebody gets a ruling in their favor, after four times of having a claim denied, now it's the prosecution's burden to appeal when the defendant should have appealed it a long time ago. This kind of thing end runs procedural rules. In this case, for example, the prisoner filed the first motion. It was denied. His time to appeal has expired long ago for that first one, and yet 2 years later, here we are. Actually, more than 2 years later, because he's effectively extended his appellate time to appeal by many, many years. Other reasons I've discussed in the brief. We need to increase the knowledge that certain claims have been litigated. If you don't appeal, that's not going to happen. I think I've sort of made the reasons for clarifying the proper doctrine or the proper bar fairly clear in my brief. So I think at this point, unless there's further questions, I'll try to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Joseph Huff. I'm from the Public Defender's Office. I represent Mr. Tolbert. My bar number is 34384. this might be the shortest argument for me that y'all ever hear, because I think that the AG and I pretty much agree on everything but two minor points. We both agree that the sentence was illegal and that under any circumstance it's got to be corrected, regardless of if you say there's a bar in place and what you might call the bar. So we agree to that, and that's the final outcome of the case. And so there's no dispute on that. The only thing we really dispute is that it seems like the AG is trying to get this court to go beyond the facts that are presented here. And in the last case, Justice Rice said it best. She said something to the effect of, we're here based upon the facts. We don't go outside of them. We're here to judge the facts that we're given. The facts that were given in this case are purely under 35A, which is a correction of an illegal sentence. I'm not talking about procedural bars that may take place under 35C, 35B. I'm solely here to talk about the correction of an illegal sentence. That's CRIMP 35A. And our position is, when it comes to the correction of an illegal sentence, there's no bar, because it's constitutional and it's a right of due process that the sentence has to be corrected if it's illegal. It's written into the statute that it says can be done at any time. There's no limitation, there's no bar, as there are in other parts of Rule 35.
Could I interrupt 1 second?
Yes, sir.
That seems like such a broad statement. Assuming you had a situation in which the defendant challenged his sentence as illegal, and actually did appeal that. Let's assume it gets to the highest court in the state and we decide the sentence is not illegal. Are you suggesting he could go back to a district court and relitigate the question whether it's legal?
Absolutely not.
Okay,
that's
so.
The only bar that I would say would be in place if you've actually litigated it to the highest court and gotten an answer. I'm talking about, and I think Mr. Seidel was talking about, filings at the trial court level. And with that, I would say, unless it's been demonstrated by the Court of Appeals or y'all denied cert or taken cert, either way, an appellate court has rendered a decision, unless that happens and it's an illegal sentence, there's absolutely no bar because the sentence continues to be illegal.
And so would it be a tactical choice for a defendant when he's denied a challenge to the legality of a sentence, would it be a tactical choice for him whether to appeal or simply go to another district court?
I don't understand another
district court. Well, I took it you were saying if he doesn't appeal, then he can. It's still, a challenge is still available on the legality of the sentence.
Absolutely, and the statute says that.
Might a defendant, rather than appealing from the denial of his 35A and finalizing the matter, if he's afraid of what result he might get in the Court of Appeals, might he then just go next door and file another 35A?
I would assume that he could file a 35A in the court which pronounced the illegal sentence.
In perpetuity.
Absolutely. And, I mean, at some point, look, trial judges, and I'm sure Justice Rice can attest to this, they get a lot of documents from a lot of inmates. And, 90% of them you just stamp denied on. If a prisoner is going to think that his sentence is illegal and doesn't want to take it up to the appellate courts, he's probably going to just keep sending the document in, and it's going to keep getting denied. At some point, he's just going to stop doing it, or at some point, he's going to take it to a higher court. But I don't really see from a judicial economy standpoint that that's such a bad thing. What's the bad thing is that if people start not trying to take these steps in the trial court, get it resolved in the trial court, but yet are appealing every single thing. And I think what Mr. Tolbert was trying to do here was get it resolved below. When that got him nowhere, he then appealed it. I think we want to encourage getting these things resolved very quickly in the trial court, as opposed to taking year upon year, wasting man hours and resources to bring it up through the appellate courts.
Could I ask one other question, slightly different on this? You started off by talking about sticking to the facts of this case. What is the situation with regard to the defendant in this case?
Well, I argued in my brief that it's moot because it actually is. He discharged a sentence, I believe, about 2 years ago. So regarding Mr. Tolbert in particular, it's entirely moot. It will have no effect whatsoever on him.
What do you consider the effect to be of a this is a published Court of Appeals opinion?
It is.
What is the effect of that with regard to mootness?
Well, I think it's important that this court come out and reverse the Court of Appeals on two points. The first point is that the remedy is bizarre. The way that they wanted to remand it back down to make judicial determinations if the court thought it was mandatory or discretionary parole, we both agree that that's wrong. The only thing that should happen here is a change in the minimus, period. There's no need to remand it and have a hearing or anything like that. So first, we'd like this court to issue an opinion saying as much, that in circumstances like these, the only proper remedy is just to fix the minimus. You don't have to remand it for any judicial fact-finding. Secondly, from our standpoint, we want this court to come out and say, when it concerns an illegal sentence and it hasn't been finally decided by an appellate court, that there are no procedural bars to correcting a legal sentence. If it's illegal, it's illegal, and this court has said time and time again, regardless of what happens, it has to be corrected, and I don't think the AG disagrees with that. If there are no
I do have a question, actually. I understand what you and the AG think in terms of the guidance we should give below, and both of you have answered the question concerning what's really at issue before us in terms of the problem of the Court of Appeals opinion and how it should be corrected. But how do we get there? I mean, this is moot, it seems to me, and I don't understand why an opinion from us would not be entirely advisory and have no effect whatsoever. I mean, it seems that the answer to the question of why should we address this, which is really a legal question, is sort of a pragmatic one, because we don't like that Court of Appeals opinion out there.
Well, I think that's a valid reason for coming out with an opinion saying why their legal reasoning is wrong in a particular case. I agree, the case is moot.
So you see that as an exception to the mootness?
I do, and I think I'm going to side with the AG to some degree. In their brief, they talk about why this issue isn't moot. I argue that it is. In one sense, it's not moot because this issue does come up a lot. In another sense, it's not moot because the Court of Appeals opinion is facially wrong, and I think this court has...
Let's address the first one, first of all. In terms of it coming up a lot, the part of that doctrine that you're missing is that it's that it's likely to evade review. And I don't understand at all why this problem is likely to evade review. This case just happens to be a particularly short sentence. These issues arise all the time, and I guess the practical question is, why not wait for another day when the issue is actually before us, rather than just something we'd like to comment on?
Well, the problem with that is that in the meantime we have a Court of Appeals opinion out there that's going to be followed, but is also erroneous, and this court presumably, and the AG and I agree, need to tell the Court of Appeals, look, this was wrong, and give the trial courts the guidance that they need. I don't know when the next case of this is going to come up, and if y'all are even going to grant cert on it when it comes up again or not, but you have the opportunity now to tell the Court of Appeals that their published opinion is flawed, and how it's flawed, and to not repeat that same mistake.
Well, that's the question, really, not the answer, is do we have the opportunity now, if this is in fact moot, and if there's no exception to the mootness doctrine, and the notion, the exception to the mootness doctrine that we don't like the Court of Appeals opinion and would like to comment is not one I'm familiar with.
Well, if you do take the AG's argument regarding mootness, then I think that that would be an exception, that it does evade review. I can't say with any certainty how often that happens, but I know it does come up a fair amount. Being a trial lawyer, a lot of my clients would file motions to correct their legal sentences. They may or may not be meritorious. But I think the point is, I really want this court to tell the Court of Appeals, when this comes up, as it often does, the remedy is just to remand it for changing of the mit. It's not to do any sort of hearing or judicial fact-finding or allow people to back out of the bargain or anything like that. So I think this court can look at it as evading review in that sense, and that if you don't step in and reverse the Court of Appeals opinion, then the trial court's going to be operating under this erroneous and misguided opinion until you do actually reach it, and it's not moot.
So what you're arguing is the minimus is the document where the sentence is recorded by the trial judge for the Department of Corrections, right? And the Department of Corrections is bound by the minimus.
Exactly.
So this is a ministerial function in a way. You're saying that the appellate court and the trial court should just correct this, amend the document, which is the sentencing order under which the Department of Corrections holds the prisoner.
Yes, absolutely. Right? And that happens in a few cases. I would say one out of five cases that I file, I put in a little section about correction of the minimus, and it's usually agreed upon by all parties. Yes, there is a mistake in the minimus. The remedy is always just to correct the minimus. It can be remanded for that purpose, but that doesn't require any sort of hearing or argument or potential to vacate the plea agreement or anything.
At least in this type of situation.
Yes, sir. If there are no other questions, I'm going to be done. Thank you.
Counsel suggested that we needn't go beyond the facts of this case, but the facts of the case include the Court of Appeals opinion, which urges lower courts to get to the merits. And specifically, I think counsel said that essentially the only bar is when something has been fully and finally litigated to the state's highest court. Otherwise, people can file these things in perpetuity. Now, that is, in my view, the penultimate waste of resources, because you have courts at the same level re-examining each other. That is purely wasteful. The reason we should look at this is because this comes up a lot, as counsel said, and we can't wait. The prosecution is never going to appeal the use of the wrong procedural bar if it wins on the merits, and the defendant's appeal is never going to ask for the right procedural bar. My time is up. I thank the court for its time and attention.
On behalf of the court, I thank both counsel for your arguments. Case stands submitted.